Blind Sight, Disc 4.
It hides now, Saresti said. It's vulnerable now. Now we go in. It wasn't news so much as review. We'd been straightlining toward Ben for days now. But perhaps the Chinese room hypothesis had strengthened his resolve. At any rate, with Rorschach and Eclipse once more, we prepared to take intrusiveness to the next level. Theseus was perpetually gravid, a generic probe incubated in her fabrication plant, its development arrested just short of birth in anticipation of unforeseen mission requirements. Sometime between briefings, the captain had brought it to parturition, customized for close contact and groundwork. It burned down the well at high G a good 10 hours before Rorschach's next scheduled appearance, inserted itself into the rock stream, and went to sleep. If our calculations were in order, it would not be smashed by some errant piece of debris before it woke up again. If all went well, an intelligence that had precisely orchestrated a cast of millions would not notice one extra dancer on the floor. If we were just plain lucky, the myriad high divers that happened to be line of sight at the time were not programmed as tattletales. Acceptable risks. If we hadn't been up for them, we might as well have stayed home. And so we waited. 4 optimized hybrids somewhere past the threshold of mere humanity, 1 extinct predator who'd opted to command us instead of eating us alive. We waited for Rorschach to come back around the bend. The probe fell smoothly around the well, an ambassador to the unwilling, or, if the gang was right, maybe just a backdoor artist set to B&E an empty condo. Spindle had named it Jack in the Box, after some antique child's toy that didn't even rate a listing in consensus. We fell in its wake, nearly ballistic now, momentum and inertia carefully precalculated to thread us through the chaotic minefield of Ben's accretion belt. Kepler couldn't do it all, though. Theseus grumbled briefly now and then, the intermittent firing of her attitude jets rumbling softly up the spine as the captain tweaked our descent into the maelstrom. No plan ever survives contact with the enemy, I remembered, but I didn't know from where. Got it, Bates said. A speck appeared at Ben's edge. The display zoomed instantly to close-up. Proximity boot. Rorschach remained invisible to Theseus, close as we were coming. But parallax stripped at least some of the scales from the probe's eyes. It woke to spikes and spirals of smoky glass flickering in and out of view, Ben's flat, endless horizon semi-visible through the intervening translucence. The view trembled. Waveforms rippled across consensus.
Quite the magnetic field, Spindle remarked.
Breaking, Bates reported. Jack turned smoothly retrograde and fired its torch. On tactical, Delta V swung to red. Sasha was driving the gang's body this shift.
Incoming signal, she reported. Same format.
Saresti clicked.
Pipe it.
Rorschach to Theseus. Hello again, Theseus. The voice was female this time, and middle-aged. Sasha grinned.
See, she's not offended at all, big hairy dick notwithstanding.
Don't answer, Saresti said. Burn complete, Bates reported. Coasting now, Jack sneezed. Silver chaff shot into the void toward the target. Millions of compass needles, brilliantly reflective, fast enough to make Theseus seem slow. They were gone in an instant. The probe watched them flee, swept laser eyes across every degree of arc, scanned its sky twice a second, and took careful note of each and every reflective flash. Only at first did those needles shoot along anything approaching a straight line. Then they swept abruptly into Lorentz spirals, twisted into sudden arcs and corkscrews, shot away along new and intricate trajectories bordering on the relativistic. The contours of Rorschach's magnetic field resolved in consensus, at first glance, like the nested layers of a glass onion. "Sparoing," Spindle said. At second glance, the onion grew wormy. Invaginations appeared, long snaking tunnels of energy proliferating fractally at every scale. Rorschach to Theseus. "Hello, Theseus. You there?" A holographic inset beside the main display plotted the points of a triangle in flux, Theseus at the apex, Rorschach and Jack defining the narrow base. "Rorschach to Theseus. I see you." "She's got a more casual affect than he ever did." Sasha glanced up at Saresti and did not add, "You sure about this?" She was starting to wonder herself, though, starting to dwell on the potential consequences of being wrong now that we were committed. As far as sober second thought was concerned, it was too little too late. But for Sasha, that was progress. Besides, it had been Saresti's decision. Great hoops were resolving in Rorschach's magnetosphere. Invisible to human eyes, their outlines were vanishingly faint even on tactical. The chaff had scattered so thinly across the sky that even the captain was resorting to guesswork. The new macro structures hovered in the magnetosphere like the nested gimbals of some great phantom gyroscope. "I see you haven't changed your vector," Rorschach remarked. "We really wouldn't advise continuing your approach. Seriously. For your own safety." Spindle shook his head. "Hey, Mandy! Rorschach talking to Jack at all?" "If it is, I'm not seeing it. No incident light, no directed EM of any kind." She smiled grimly. "Seems to have snuck in under the radar. And don't call me Mandy." Theseus groaned, twisting. I staggered in the low pseudo-grav, reached out to steady myself. "Course correction," Bates reported, "on plotted rock." "Rorschach to Theseus, please respond. Your current heading is unacceptable. Repeat, your current heading is unacceptable. Strongly advise you change course." By now, the probe coasted just a few kilometers off Rorschach's leading edge. That close, it served up way more than magnetic fields. It presented Rorschach itself in bright tactical color codes. Invisible curves and spikes iridesced in consensus across any number of on-demand pigment schemes, gravity, reflectivity, black body emissions. Massive electrical bolts erupting from the tips of thorns rendered in lemon pastels. User-friendly graphics had turned Rorschach into a cartoon. "Rorschach to Theseus, please respond." Theseus growled to stern, fishtailing. On tactical, another just-plotted piece of debris swept by a discreet 6,000 meters to port. "Rorschach to Theseus, if you are unable to respond, please—" Holy shit! The cartoon flickered and died. I'd seen what had happened in that last instant, though. Jack passing near one of those great phantom hoops, a tongue of energy flicking out, quick as a frog's, a dead feed. "I see what you're up to now, you cocksuckers. Do you think we're fucking blind down here?" Sasha clenched her teeth. "We—" "No," Saresti said. "But it—" Saresti hissed from somewhere in the back of his throat. I had never heard a mammal make a noise quite like that before. Sasha fell immediately silent. Bates negotiated with her controls. "I still got—" "Just a sec. You pull that thing back right fucking now, you hear us? Right fucking now." "Got it," Bates gritted as the feed came back up. "Just had to reacquire the laser." The probe had been kicked wildly off course, as if someone fording a river had been caught in sudden undertow and thrown over a waterfall. But it was still talking and still mobile. Barely. Bates struggled to stay the course. Jack staggered and wobbled uncontrollably through the tightly wound folds of Rorschach's magnetosphere. The artifact loomed huge in its eye. The feed strobed.
"Maintain approach," Sarasti said calmly.
"Love to," Bates bit out. "Trying." Theseus skidded again, corkscrewing. I could have sworn I heard the bearings in the drum grind for a moment. Another rock sailed past on tactical.
"I thought you'd plotted those things," Spindle grumbled.
"You want to start a war, Theseus? Is that what you're trying to do? You think you're up for it?"
"It doesn't attack," Sarasti said.
"Maybe it does." Bates kept her voice low. I could see the effort it took. "If Rorschach can control the trajectories of these
normal distribution, insignificant corrections."
He must have meant statistically. The torque and grind of the ship's hull felt pretty significant to the others.
"Oh, right," Rorschach said suddenly. "We get it now. You don't think there's anyone here, do you? You've got some high-priced consultant telling you there's nothing to worry about."
Jack was deep in the forest. We'd lost most of the tactical overlays to reduced BOD. In dim visible light, Rorschach's great ridged spines, each the size of a skyscraper, hashed a nightmare view on all sides. The feed stuttered as Bates struggled to keep the beam aligned. Consensus painted walls and airspace with arcane telemetry. I had no idea what any of it meant.
"You think we're nothing but a Chinese room," Rorschach sneered.
Jack stumbled toward collision, grasping for something to hang on to.
"Your mistake, Theseus."
It hit something. It stuck. And suddenly Rorschach snapped into view. No refractory composites, no profiles or simulations in false color. There it was, at last, naked even to human eyes. Imagine a crown of thorns, twisted, dark, and unreflective, grown too thickly tangled to ever rest on any human head. Put it in orbit around a failed star whose own reflected half-light does little more than throw its satellites into silhouette. Occasional bloody highlights glinted like dim embers from its twists and crannies. They only emphasized the darkness everywhere else. Imagine an artifact that embodies the very notion of torture, something so wrenched and disfigured that even across uncounted light years and unimaginable differences in biology and outlook, you can't help but feel that somehow the structure itself is in pain. Now, make it the size of a city. It flickered as we watched. Lightning arced from recurved spines 1,000 meters long. Consensus showed us a strobe-lit hellscape, huge and dark and twisted. The composites had lied. It was not the least bit beautiful.
"Now it's too late," something said from deep inside. "Now every last one of you is dead. And Susan? You there, Susan? We're taking you first."
"Life's too short for chess," Lord Byron. They never sealed the hatch behind them. It was too easy to get lost up there in the dome, naked infinite space stretching 180 degrees on every axis. They needed all that emptiness, but they needed an anchor in its midst. Soft stray light from a stern, a gentle draft from the drum, the sounds of people and machinery close by. They needed to have it both ways. I lay in wait, reading a dozen blatant cues in their behavior. I was already squirreled away in the forward airlock when they passed. I gave them a few minutes, and crept forward to the darkened bridge.
Of course they called her by name, Spindle was saying. That was the only name they had. She told them, remember?
Yes, Michelle didn't seem reassured.
Hey, it was you guys said we were talking to a Chinese room. You saying you were wrong?
No, of course not.
Then it wasn't really threatening Suze at all, was it? It wasn't threatening any of us. It had no idea what it was saying.
It's rule-based, Isaac. It was following some kind of flowchart it drew up by observing human languages in action, and somehow those rules told it to respond with threats of violence.
But if it doesn't even know what it was saying, it doesn't, it can't.
We parsed the phrasing 19 different ways, tried out conceptual units of every different length. A long, deep breath.
But it attacked the probe, Isaac. Jack just got too close to one of those electrode thingies, is all. It just arced.
So you don't think Rorschach is hostile? Long silence. Long enough to make me wonder if I'd been detected.
Hostile, Spindle said at last. Friendly. We learn those words for life on Earth, eh? I don't know if they even apply out here.
His lips smacked faintly.
But I think it might be something like hostile.
Michelle sighed.
Isaac, there's no reason for... I mean, it just doesn't make sense that it would be. We can't have anything it wants.
It says it wants to be left alone, Spindle said, even if it doesn't mean it. They floated quietly for a while, up there past the bulkhead.
At least the shielding held, Spindle said finally. That's something.
He wasn't just talking about Jack. Our own carapace was coated with the same stuff now. It had depleted our substrate stockpiles by 2/3, but no one wanted to rely on the ship's usual magnetics in the face of anything that could play so easily with the electromagnetic spectrum.
If they attack us, what do we do?
Michelle said.
Learn what we can while we can. Fight back while we can. If we can. Look out there, Isaac. I don't care how embryonic that thing is. Tell me we're not hopelessly outmatched.
Outmatched, for sure. Hopelessly? Never.
That's not what you said before.
Still, there's always a way to win.
If I said that, you'd call it wishful thinking.
If you said that, it would be. But I'm saying it, so it's game theory.
Game theory again, Jesus, Isaac. No, listen, you're thinking about the aliens like they were some kind of mammal, something that cares, something that looks after its investments.
How do you know they aren't?
Because you can't protect your kids when they're light years away. They're on their own, and it's a big, cold, dangerous universe, so most of them aren't going to make it, eh? The most you can do is crank out millions of kids, take cold comfort in knowing that a few always luck out through random chance. It's not a mammal mindset, Mish. You want an earthbound simile, think of dandelion seeds. Or herring.
A soft sigh. So they're interstellar herring. That hardly means they can't crush us.
But they don't know about us, not in advance. Dandelion seed doesn't know what it's up against before it sprouts. Maybe nothing. Maybe some spastic weed that goes over like straw in the wind. Or maybe something that kicks its ass halfway to the Magellanic Clouds. It doesn't know, and there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all survival strategy. Something that aces against one player blows goats against a different one. So the best you can do is mix your strategies based on the odds. It's a weighted dice roll, and it gives you the best mean payoff over the whole game, but you're bound to crap out and choose the wrong strategy at least some of the time. Price of doing business. And that means that weak players not only can win against stronger ones, but they're statistically bound to in some cases.
Michelle snorted.
That's your game theory. Rock, paper, scissors with statistics.
Maybe Spindle didn't know the reference. He didn't speak long enough to call up a subtitle. Then he brayed like a horse.
Rock, paper, scissors. Yes.
Michelle digested that for a moment. You're sweet for trying, but that only works if the other side is just blindly playing the odds, and they don't have to do that if they know who they're going up against in advance. And my dear, they have so very much information about us. They'd threatened Susan. By name.
They don't know everything, Spindle insisted, and the principle works for any scenario involving incomplete information, not just the ignorant extreme.
Not as well.
But some, and that gives us a chance. Doesn't matter how good you are at poker when it comes to the deal, eh? Cards still deal out with the same odds.
So that's what we're playing? Poker.
Be thankful it's not chess. We wouldn't have a hope in hell.
Hey, I'm supposed to be the optimist in this relationship.
You are. I'm just fatalistically cheerful. We come into the story halfway through, we all catch up as best we can, and we're all gonna die before it ends.
That's my Isaac, master of the no-win scenario.
You can win. Winner's the guy who makes the best guess on how it all comes out.
So you are just guessing?
Yep. And you can't make an informed guess without data, eh? And we could be the very first to find out what's going to happen to the whole human race. I'd say that puts us into the semifinals easy.
Michelle didn't answer for a very long time. When she did, I couldn't hear her words. Neither could Spindle.
Sorry?
Covert to invulnerable, you said? Remember?
Uh-huh.
Rorschach's graduation day. How soon, do you think?
No idea. But I don't think it's the kind of thing that's going to slip by unnoticed. And that's why I don't think it attacked us.
She must have looked a question.
Because when it does, it won't be some debatable candy-ass bitch slap, he told her. When that fucker rises up, we're gonna know.
A sudden flicker from behind. I spun in the cramped passageway and bit down on a cry. Something squirmed out of sight around the corner, something with arms, barely glimpsed, gone in an instant. Never there. Couldn't be there. Impossible.
Did you hear that?
Spindle asked, but I'd fled to Stern before Michelle could answer him. We'd fallen so far that the naked eye didn't see a disc, barely even saw curvature anymore. We were falling towards a wall, a vast roiling expanse of dark thunderclouds that extended in all directions to some new, infinitely distant horizon. Ben filled half the universe, and still we fell. Far below, Jack clung to Rorschach's ridge surface with bristly gecko feet fenders and set up camp. It sent X-rays and ultrasound into the ground, tapped inquiring fingers and listened to the echoes, planted tiny explosive charges and measured the resonance of their detonations. It shed seeds like pollen, tiny probes and sensors by the thousands, self-powered, nearsighted, stupid, and expendable. The vast majority were sacrificial offerings to random chance. Only 1 in 100 lasted long enough to return usable telemetry. While our advanced scout took measure of its local neighborhood, Theseus drew large-scale bird's-eye maps from the closing sky. It spat out thousands of its own disposable probes, spread them across the heavens, and collected stereoscopic data from 1,000 simultaneous perspectives. Patchwork insights assembled in the drum. Rorschach's skin was 60% superconducting carbon nanotube. Rorschach's guts were largely hollow. At least some of those hollows appeared to contain an atmosphere. No earthly form of life would have lasted a second in there, though. Intricate topographies of radiation and electromagnetic force seethed around the structure, seethed within it. In some places, the radiation was intense enough to turn unshielded flesh to ash in an instant. Calmer backwaters would merely kill in the same span of time. Charged particles raced around invisible racetracks at relativistic speeds, erupting from jagged openings, hugging curves of magnetic force strong enough for neutron stars, arcing through open space and plunging back into black mass. Occasional protuberances swelled and burst and released clouds of microparticulates, seeding the radiation belts like spores. Rorschach resembled nothing so much as a nest of half-naked cyclotrons, tangled one with another. Neither Jack below nor Theseus above could find any points of entry beyond those impassable gaps that spat out streams of charged particles or swallowed them back down. No airlocks or hatches or viewports resolved with increasing proximity. The fact that we'd been threatened via laser beam implied some kind of optical antennae or tightcast array. We weren't even able to find that much. A central hallmark of von Neumann machines was self-replication. Whether Rorschach would meet that criterion, whether it would germinate or divide or give birth when it passed some critical threshold, whether it had done so already, remained an open question. One of a thousand. At the end of it all, after all the measurements, the theorizing and deduction and outright guesswork, we settled into orbit with a million trivial details and no answers. In terms of the big questions, there was only one thing we knew for sure. So far, Rorschach was holding its fire. "It sounded to me like it knew what it was saying," I remarked. "I guess that's the whole point," Bates said. She had no one to confide in, partook of no intimate dialogues that could be overheard. With her, I used the direct approach. Theseus was birthing a litter, two by two. They were nasty-looking things, armored, squashed egg shapes, twice the size of a human torso and studded with gardening implements, antennae, optical ports, retractable thread saws, weapons muzzles. Bates was summoning her troops. We floated before the primary fab port at the base of Theseus's spine. The plant could just as easily have disgorged the grunts directly into the hold beneath the carapace. That was where they'd be stored anyway, until called upon. But Bates was giving each a visual inspection before sending it through one of the airlocks a few meters up the passageway. Ritual, perhaps. Military tradition. Certainly there was nothing she could see with her eyes that wouldn't be glaringly obvious to the most basic diagnostic. "Would it be a problem?" I asked. "Running them without your interface?" "Run themselves just fine. Response time actually improves without spam in the network. I'm more of a safety precaution." Theseus growled, giving us more attitude. The plating trembled to stern, another piece of local debris no longer in our path. We were angling toward an equatorial orbit just a few minuscule kilometers above the artifact. Insanely, the approach curved right through the accretion belt. It didn't bother the others. "Like surviving traffic in a high-speed lane," Sasha had said, disdainful of my misgivings. "Try creeping across in your roadkill. Gotta speed up, go with the flow." But the flow was turbulent. We hadn't gone 5 minutes without a course correction since Rorschach had stopped talking to us. "So do you buy it?" I asked. "Pattern matching, empty threats, nothing to worry about?" "Nobody's fired on us yet," she said, meaning, "not for a second." "What's your take on Susan's argument? Different niches, no reason for conflict?" "Makes sense, I guess." "Utter bullshit. Can you think of any reason why something with such different needs would attack us?" "That depends," she said, "on whether the fact that we are different is reason enough." I saw playground battlefields reflected in her topology. I remembered my own and wondered if there were any other kind. Then again, that only proved the point. Humans didn't really fight over skin tone or ideology. Those were just handy cues for kin selection purposes. Ultimately, it always came down to bloodlines and limited resources. "I think Isaac would say this is different," I said.
"I guess."
Bates sent one grunt humming off to the hold. Two more emerged in formation, spine-light glinting off their armor. How many of these are you making, anyway? We're breaking and entering, Siri. Not wise to leave our own house unguarded. I inspected her surfaces as she inspected theirs. Doubt and resentment simmered just beneath. You're in a tough spot, I remarked. We all are. But you're responsible for defending us against something we don't know anything about. We're only guessing that Saresti doesn't guess, Bates said. The man's in charge for a reason. Doesn't make much sense to question his orders, given we're all about 100 IQ points short of understanding the answer anyway. And yet he's also got that whole predatory side nobody talks about, I remarked. It must be difficult for him, all that intellect coexisting with so much instinctive aggression. Make sure the right part wins. She wondered in that instant whether Saresti might be listening in. She decided in the next that it didn't matter. Why should he care what the cattle thought, as long as they did what they were told? All she said was, I thought you jargonauts weren't supposed to have opinions. That wasn't mine. Bates paused, returned to her inspection. You do know what I do, I said. Uh-huh. The first of the current pair passed muster and hummed off up the spine. She turned to the second. You simplify things, so the folks back home can understand what the specialists are up to. That's part of it. I don't need a translator, Siri. I'm just a consultant, assuming things go well. A bodyguard if they don't. You're an officer and a military expert. I'd say that makes you more qualified when it comes to assessing Rorschach's threat potential. I'm muscle. Shouldn't you be simplifying Yuka or Isaac? That's exactly what I'm doing. She looked at me. You interact, I said. Every component of the system affects every other. Processing Saresti without factoring you in would be like trying to calculate acceleration while ignoring mass. She turned back to her brood. Another robot passed muster. She didn't hate me. What she hated was what my presence implied. They don't trust us to speak for ourselves, she wouldn't say. No matter how qualified we are, no matter how far ahead of the pack. Maybe even because of that. We're contaminated. We're subjective. So they send Siri Keaton to tell them what we really mean. I get it, I said after a moment. Do you? It's not about trust, Major. It's about location. Nobody gets a good view of a system from the inside, no matter who they are. The view's distorted. And yours isn't. I'm outside the system. You're interacting with me now. As an observer only. Perfection's unattainable, but it isn't unapproachable, you know? I don't play a role in decision-making or research. I don't interfere in any aspect of the mission that I'm assigned to study. But of course I ask questions. The more information I have, the better my analysis. I thought you didn't have to ask. I thought you guys could just read the signs or something. Every bit helps. It all goes into the mix. You're doing it now? Synthesizing? I nodded. And you do this without any specialized knowledge at all? I'm as much of a specialist as you. I specialize in processing informational topologies. Without understanding their content. Understanding the shapes is enough. Bates seemed to find some small imperfection in the BattleBot under scrutiny, scratched at its shell with a fingernail. Software couldn't do that without your help. Software can do a lot of things. We've chosen to do some for ourselves. I nodded at the grunt. Your visual inspections, for example. She smiled faintly, conceding the point. So I'd encourage you to speak freely. You know I'm sworn to confidentiality. Thanks, she said, meaning, on this ship there's no such thing. Theseus chimed. Saresti spoke in its wake. Orbital insertion in 15 minutes. Everyone to the drum in 5. Well, Bates said, sending one last grunt on its way. Here we go. She pushed off and sailed up the spine. The newborn killing machines clicked at me. They smelled like new cars. By the way, Bates called over her shoulder, you missed the obvious one. Sorry? She spun 180 degrees at the end of the passageway, landed like an acrobat beside the drum hatch. The reason why something would attack us even if we didn't have anything it wanted. I read it off her. If it wasn't attacking at all, if it was defending itself. You asked about Saristi? Smart man, strong leader. Maybe could spend a little more time with the troops. Vampire doesn't respect his command, doesn't listen to advice, hides away half the time. I remembered transient killer whales. Maybe he's being considerate? He knows he makes us nervous. I'm sure that's it, Bates said. Vampire doesn't trust himself. It wasn't just Saristi. They all hid from us, even when they had the upper hand. They always stayed just the other side of myth. It started pretty much the same way it did for anything else. Vampires were far from the first to learn the virtues of energy conservation. Shrews and hummingbirds, saddled with tiny bodies and overclocked metabolic engines, would have starved to death overnight if not for the torpor that overtook them at sundown. Comatose elephant seals lurked breathless at the bottom of the sea, rousing only for passing prey or redline lactate levels. Bears and chipmunks cut costs by sleeping away the impoverished winter months, and lungfish, Devonian black belts in the art of estivation, could curl up and die for years waiting for the rains. With vampires, it was a little different. It wasn't shortness of breath or metabolic overdrive, or some blanket of snow that locked the pantry every winter. The problem wasn't so much a lack of prey as a lack of difference from it. Vampires were such a recent split from the ancestral baseline that the reproductive rates hadn't diverged. This was no woodland variety lynx hair dynamic, where prey outnumbered predators 100-1. Vampires fed on things that bred barely faster than they did. They would have wiped out their own food supply in no time if they hadn't learned how to ease off on the throttle. By the time they went extinct, they'd learned to shut down for decades. It made two kinds of sense. It not only slashed their metabolic needs while prey bred itself back to harvestable levels, it gave us time to forget that we were prey. We were so smart by the Pleistocene, smart enough for easy skepticism. If you haven't seen any night-stalking demons in all your years on the savannah, why would you believe some senile campfire ramblings passed down by your mother's mother? It was murder on our ancestors, even if those same enemy genes, co-opted now, served us so well when we left the sun 500,000 years later. But it was almost heartening, I guess, to think that maybe Saristi felt the tug of other genes, some aversion to prolonged visibility shaped by generations of natural selection. Maybe he spent every moment in our company fighting voices that urged him to hide, hide, let them forget. Maybe he retreated when they got too loud. Maybe we made him as uneasy as he made us. We could always hope. Our final orbit combined discretion and valor in equal measure. Rorschach described a perfect equatorial circle 87,900 kilometers from Big Ben's center of gravity. Saristi was unwilling to let it out of sight, and you didn't have to be a vampire to mistrust relay stats when swinging through a radiation-soaked blizzard of rock and machinery. The obvious alternative was to match orbits. At the same time, all the debate over whether or not Rorschach had meant or even understood the threats it had made was a bit beside the point. Counter-intrusion measures were a distinct possibility either way, and ongoing proximity only increased the risk. So Saresti had derived some optimum compromise, a mildly eccentric orbit that nearly brushed the artifact at perigee but kept a discrete distance the rest of the time. It was a longer trajectory than Rorschach's, and higher. We had to burn on the descending arc to keep in sync. But the end result was continuously line of sight and only brought us within striking distance for 3 hours either side of bottoming out. Our striking distance, that is. For all we knew, Rorschach could have reached out and swatted us from the sky before we'd even left the solar system. Saresti gave the command from his tent. Consensus carried his voice into the drum as Theseus coasted to apogee. Now. Jack had erected a tent about itself, a blister glued to Rorschach's hull and blown semi-taut against vacuum with the merest whiff of nitrogen. Now it brought lasers to bear and started digging. If we'd read the vibrations right, the ground should only be 34 centimeters deep beneath its feet. The beams stuttered as they cut, despite 6 millimeters of doped shielding. Son of a bitch, Spindle murmured. It's working. We burned through tough fibrous epidermis. We burned through veins of insulation that might have been some sort of programmable asbestos. We burned through alternating layers of superconducting mesh and the strata of flaking carbon separating them. We burned through. The lasers shut down instantly. Within seconds, Rorschach's intestinal gases had blown taut the skin of the tent. Black carbon smoke swirled and danced in sudden thick atmosphere. Nothing shot back at us. Nothing reacted. Partial pressures piled up on consensus. Methane, ammonia, hydrogen, lots of water vapor freezing as fast as it registered. Spindle grunted. Reducing atmosphere, pre-snowball, he sounded disappointed. Maybe it's a work in progress, James suggested, like the structure itself. Maybe. Jack stuck out its tongue, a giant mechanical sperm with a myo-optical tail. Its head was a thick-skinned lozenge, at least half ceramic shielding by cross-section. The tiny payload of sensors at its core was rudimentary, but small enough for the whole assembly to thread through the pencil-thin hole the laser had cut. It unspooled down the hole, rimming Rorschach's newly torn orifice. Dark down there, James observed. Bates, but warm. 281 degrees Kelvin, above freezing. The endoscope emerged into darkness. Infrared served up a grainy grayscale of a tunnel, it looked like, replete with mist and exotic rock formations. The walls curved like honeycomb, like the insides of fossilized intestine. Cul-de-sacs and branches proliferated down the passage. The basic substrate appeared to be a dense pastry of carbon fiber leaves. Some of the gaps between those layers were barely thick as fingernails. Others looked wide enough to stack bodies. Ladies and gentlemen, Spindle said softly, the devil's baklava. I could have sworn I saw something move. I could have sworn it looked familiar. The camera died. Rorschach. Mothers are fonder than fathers of their children, because they are more certain they are their own. Aristotle. I couldn't say goodbye to Dad. I didn't even know where he was. I didn't want to say goodbye to Helen. I didn't want to go back there. That was the problem. I didn't have to. There was nowhere left in the world where the mountain couldn't simply pick up and move to Muhammad. Heaven was merely a suburb of the global village, and the global village left me no excuse. I linked from my own apartment. My new inlays, mission-specific, slid into my head just the week before, shook hands with the noosphere and knocked upon the pearly gates. Some tame spirit, more plausible than St. Peter, if no less ethereal, took a message and disappeared. And I was inside. This was no antechamber, no visiting room. Heaven was not intended for the casual visitor. Any paradise in which the flesh constrained would feel at home would have been intolerably pedestrian to the disembodied souls who lived there. Of course, there was no reason why visitor and resident had to share the same view. I could have pulled any conventional worldview off the shelf if I'd wanted, seen this place rendered in any style I chose. Except for the ascended themselves, of course. That was one of the perks of the afterlife. Only they got to choose the face we saw. But the thing my mother had become had no face, and I was damned if she was going to see me hide behind some mask. "Hello, Helen." "Siri, what a wonderful surprise." She was an abstraction in an abstraction, an impossible intersection of dozens of bright panes, as if the disassembled tiles of a stained glass window had each been set aglow and animated. She swirled before me like a school of fish. Her world echoed her body, lights and angles and three-dimensional Escher impossibilities, piled like bright thunderheads. And yet somehow I would have recognized her anywhere. Heaven was a dream. Only upon waking do you realize that the characters you encountered look nothing like they do in real life. There was only one familiar landmark anywhere in the whole sensorium. My mother's heaven smelled of cinnamon. I beheld her luminous avatar and imagined the corpus soaking in a tank of nutrients deep underground. "How are you doing?" "Very well, very well. Of course it takes a little getting used to, knowing your mind isn't quite yours anymore." Heaven didn't just feed the brains of its residents. It fed off them, used the surplus power of idle synapses to run its own infrastructure. "You have to move in here, sooner better than later. You'll never leave." "Actually, I am leaving," I said. "We're shipping out tomorrow."
"Shipping out?
The Kuiper? You know, the fireflies."
"Oh, yes, I think I heard something about that. We don't get much news from the outside world, you know."
"Anyway, just thought I'd call in and say goodbye."
"I'm glad you did. I've been hoping to see you without, you know."
"Without what?"
"You know, without your father listening in."
"Not again." "Dad's in the field, Helen. Interplanetary crisis. You might have heard something."
"I certainly have. You know, I haven't always been happy about your father's extended assignments, but maybe it was really a blessing in disguise. The less he was around, the less he could do."
"Do?"
"To you."
The apparition stilled for a few moments, feigning hesitation.
"I've never told you this before, but..."
"No, I shouldn't."
"Shouldn't what?" "Bring up, well, old hurts."
"What old hurts?" Right on cue, I couldn't help myself. The training went too deep. I always barked on command.
"Well," she began, "sometimes you'd come back, you were so very young, and your face would be so set and hard, and I'd wonder, why are you so angry, little boy? What can someone so young have to be so angry about?"
"Helen, what are you talking about? Back from where?"
"Just from the places he'd take you."
Something like a shiver passed across her facets.
"He was still around back then. He wasn't so important. He was just an accountant with a karate fetish, going on about forensics and game theory and astronomy until he put everyone to sleep."
I tried to imagine it. My father, the chatterbox.
"That doesn't sound like Dad."
"Well, of course not.
You were too young to remember, but he was just a little man then. He still is, really, under all the secret missions and classified briefings. I've never understood why people never saw that. But even back then, he liked to... Well, it wasn't his fault, I suppose. He had a very difficult childhood, and he never learned to deal with problems like an adult. He'd throw his weight around, I guess you'd say. Of course, I didn't know that before we married. If I had, But I made a commitment. I made a commitment, and I never broke it.
What, are you saying you were abused? Back from the places he'd take you.
Are you saying I was?
There are all kinds of abuse, Siri. Words can hurt more than bullets sometimes. And child abandonment, he didn't abandon me. He left me with you.
He abandoned us, Siri, sometimes for months at a time, and we never knew if he was coming back. And he chose to do that to us, Siri. He didn't need that job. There were so many other things he was qualified to do, things that had been redundant for years.
I shook my head, incredulous, unable to say it aloud.
She hated him because he hadn't had the good grace to grow unnecessary?
It's not Dad's fault that planetary security is still an essential service, I said. She continued as if she hadn't heard.
Now, there was a time when it was unavoidable, when people our age had to work just to make ends meet. But even back then, people wanted to spend time with their families, even if they couldn't afford to choose to stay working when it isn't even necessary. That's...
She shattered and reassembled at my shoulder.
Yes, Siri, I believe that's a kind of abuse. And if your father had been half as loyal to me as I've been to him all these years...
I remembered Jim, the last time I'd seen him, snorting vasopressin under the restless eyes of robot sentries. I don't think Dad's been disloyal to either of us.
Helen sighed. I don't really expect you to understand. I'm not completely stupid. I've seen how it played out. I pretty much had to raise you myself all these years. I always had to play the heavy, always had to be the one to hand out the discipline because your father was off on some secret assignment. And then he'd come home for a week or two, and he was the golden-haired boy just because he'd seen fit to drop in. I don't really blame you for that any more than I blame him. Blame doesn't solve anything at this stage. I just thought, well, really, I thought you ought to know. Take it for what it's worth. A memory, unbidden, called into Helen's bed when I was 9, her hand stroking my scar, her stale sweet breath stirring against my cheek. You're the man of the house now, Siri. We can't count on your father anymore. It's just you and me. I didn't say anything for a while. Finally, didn't it help at all?
What do you mean?
I glanced around at all that customized abstraction, internal feedback lucidly dreamed. You're omnipotent in here. Desire anything, imagine anything, there it is. I thought it would have changed you more. Rainbow tiles danced and forced a laugh.
This isn't enough of a change for you.
Not nearly. Because heaven had a catch. No matter how many constructs and avatars Helen built in there, no matter how many empty vessels sang her praises or commiserated over the injustices she'd suffered, when it came right down to it, she was only talking to herself. There were other realities over which she had no control, other people who didn't play by her rules. And if they thought of Helen at all, they thought as they damn well pleased. She could go the rest of her life without ever meeting any of them. But she knew they were out there, and it drove her crazy. Taking my leave of heaven, it occurred to me that omnipotent though she was, there was only one way my mother would ever be truly happy in her own personal creation. The rest of creation would have to go. This shouldn't be happening, Bates said. The shielding was good. The gang was up across the drum, squaring away something in their tent. Saristi lurked off stage today, monitoring the proceedings from his quarters. That left me with Bates and Spindle in the commons.
Maybe against direct EM, Spindle stretched, stifled a yawn. Ultrasound boots up magnetic fields through shielding sometimes, in living tissue at least. Any chance something like that could be happening with your electronics?
Bates spread her hands. Who knows?
Might as well be black magic and elves down there.
Well, it's not a total wash. We can make a few smart guesses, eh?
Such as?
Spindle raised one finger.
The layers we cut through couldn't result from any metabolic process I know about, so it's not alive, not in the biological sense. Not that that means anything these days, he added, glancing around the belly of our beast.
What about life inside the structure?
Anoxic atmosphere probably rules out complex multicellular life. Microbes maybe, although if so, I wish to hell they'd show up in the samples. But anything complex enough to think, let alone build something like that, a wave at the image and consensus, is going to need a high-energy metabolism, and that means oxygen.
So you think it's empty?
Didn't say that, did I? I know aliens are supposed to be all mysterious and everything, but I still don't see why anyone would build a city-sized wildlife refuge for anaerobic microbes.
It's got to be a habitat for something. Why any atmosphere at all if it's just some sort of terraforming machine?
Spindle pointed up at the gang's tent.
What Susan said, atmosphere's still under construction, and we get a free ride until the owners show up.
Free?
Free-ish. And I know we've seen only a fraction of what's inside, but something obviously saw us coming. It yelled at us, as I recall. If they're smart and they're hostile, why aren't they shooting?
Maybe they are.
If something's hiding down the hall wrecking your robots, it's not frying them any faster than the baseline environment would do anyway.
What you call a baseline environment might be an active counter-intrusion measure. Why else would a habitat be so uninhabitable?
Spindle rolled his eyes.
Okay, I was wrong. We don't know enough to make a few smart guesses.
Not that we hadn't tried. Once Jack's sensor head had been irreparably fried, we'd relegated it to surface excavation. It had widened the bore in infinitesimal increments, patiently burning back the edges of our initial peephole until it measured almost a meter across. Meanwhile, we'd customized Bates's grunts, shielded them against nuclear reactors and the insides of cyclotrons. And come perigee, we'd throw them at Rorschach like stones chucked into a haunted forest.
Each had gone through Jack's portal, unspooling whisker-thin fiber top behind them to pass intelligence through the charged atmosphere. They'd sent glimpses, mostly. A few extended vignettes. We'd seen Rorschach's walls move, slow, lazy waves of peristalsis rippling along its gut. We'd seen treacly invaginations in progress, painstaking constrictions that would presumably, given time, seal off a passageway. Our grunts had sailed through some quarters, staggered through others where the magnetic ambience threw them off balance. They'd passed through strange throats lined with razor-thin teeth, thousands of triangular blades and parallel rows, helically twisted. They'd edged cautiously around clouds of mist sculpted into abstract fractal shapes, shifting and endlessly recursive, their charged droplets strung along a myriad converging lines of electromagnetic force. Ultimately, every one of them had died or disappeared.
Any way to increase the shielding? I wondered.
Spindle gave me a look.
We've shielded everything except the sensor heads, Bates explained. If we shield those, we're blind.
But visible light's harmless enough. What about purely optical light?
We're using optical links, Commissar, Spindle snapped. And you may have noticed the shit's getting through anyway.
But aren't there, you know, I groped for the word, band pass filters? Something that lets visible wavelengths through, cuts out the lethal stuff on both sides?
He snorted.
Sure, it's called an atmosphere. And if we'd brought one with us, about 50 times deeper than Earth's, it might block some of that soup down there.
Of course, Earth also gets a lot of help from its magnetic field, but I'm not betting my life on any EM we set up in that place.
If we didn't keep running into these spikes, Bates said, that's the real problem.
Are they random? I wondered.
Spindle's shrug was half shiver.
I don't think anything about that place is random, but who knows? We need more data.
Which we're not likely to get, James said, walking around the ceiling to join us, if our drones keep shorting out. The conditional was pure formality,
We tried playing the odds, sacrificing drone after drone in the hope that one of them would get lucky. Survival rates tailed exponentially to zero with distance from base camp. We tried shielding the fiber top to reduce aperture leakage. The resulting tethers were stiff and unwieldy, wrapped in so many layers of ferro-ceramic that we were virtually waving the bots around on the end of a stick. We tried cutting the tethers entirely, sending the machines out to explore on their own, squinting against the radiant blizzard and storing their findings for later download. None had returned. We tried everything.
"We can go in ourselves," James said.
"Almost everything."
"Right," Spindle replied in a voice that couldn't mean anything but wrong.
"It's the only way to learn anything useful."
"Yeah, like how many seconds it would take your brain to turn into synchrotron soup."
"Our suits can be shielded."
"Oh, you mean like Mandy's drones?"
"I'd really rather you didn't call me that," Bates remarked.
"The point is, Rorschach kills you whether you're meat or mechanical."
"My point is, it kills meat differently," James replied. "It takes longer."
Spindle shook his head. "You'd be good as dead in 50 minutes, even shielded, even in the so-called cool zones.
And completely asymptomatic for 3 hours or more. And even after that, it would take days for us to actually die, and we'd be back here long before then, and the ship could patch us up just like that. We even know that much, Isaac. It's right there in consensus. And if we know it, you know it. So we shouldn't even be having this argument."
"That's your solution? We saturate ourselves with radiation every 30 hours, and then I get to cut out the tumors and stitch everyone's cells back together?"
"The pods are automatic. You wouldn't have to lift a finger.
Not to mention the number of those magnetic fields would do on your brain. We'd be hallucinating from the moment we..."
"Faraday the suits."
"Oh, so we go in deaf, dumb, and blind. Good idea."
"We can let light pass, infrared. It's all EM, Suze. Even if we blacked out our helmets completely and used a camera feed, we'd get leakage where the wire went through."
"Some, yes, but it'd be better than..." "Jesus!"
A tremor sent spittle sailing from the corner of Spindle's mouth.
"Let me talk to Mich..."
"I've discussed it with the rest of the gang, Isaac. We're all agreed."
"All agreed? You don't have a working majority in there, Suze. Just because you cut your brain into pieces doesn't mean they each get a vote."
"I don't see why not. We're each at least as sentient as you are."
"They're all you, just partitioned."
"You don't seem to have any trouble treating Michelle as a separate individual."
"Michelle's... I mean, yes, you're all very different facets, but there's only one original."
"Your alters..."
"Don't call us that,"
Sasha erupted with a voice cold as locks.
"Ever."
Spindle tried to pull back.
"I didn't mean... You know, I didn't..."
But Sasha was gone.
"What are you saying?"
said the softer voice in her wake.
"Do you think I'm just mom play acting? You think when we're together you're alone with her?"
"Michelle," Spindle said miserably.
"No, what I think..."
"Doesn't matter," Saresti said. "We don't vote here."
He floated above us, visored and unreadable in the center of the drum. None of us had seen him arrive. He turned slowly on his axis, keeping us in view as we rotated around him.
"Prepping Scylla. Amanda needs 2 untethered grunts with precautionary armament, cams from 1 to 1,000,000 angstroms, shielded tympanics, no autonomous circuitry, platelet boosters,
diamine hydronate and potassium iodide for everyone by 1350.
"Everyone?" Bates asked. Saresti nodded.
"Window opens 4 hours 23.
He turned back down the spine.
"Not me," I said.
Saresti paused.
"I don't participate in field ops," I reminded him.
"Now you do."
"I'm a synthesist."
He knew that. Of course he knew. Everyone did. You can't observe the system unless you stay outside the system.
"On Earth, you're a synthesist," he said. "In the Kuiper, you're a synthesist. Here, you're mass. Do what you're told."
He disappeared, Welcome to the big picture, Bates said softly. I looked at her as the rest of the group broke up. You know, we're a long way out, Siri. Can't wait 14 months for feedback from your bosses, and you know it. She leapt from a standing start, arced smoothly through holograms into the weightless core of the drum. But then she stopped herself, as if distracted by some sudden insight. She grabbed a spinal conduit and swung back to face me. You shouldn't sell yourself short, she said. Or Saristi, either. You're an observer, right? It's a safe bet there's going to be a lot down there worth observing. Thanks, I said. But I already knew why Saristi was sending me into Rorschach, and there was more to it than observation. 3 valuable agents in harm's way. A decoy bought 1 in 4 odds that an enemy would aim somewhere else. The Lord will take control of you. You will dance and shout and become a different person. 1 Samuel 10:6. We were probably fractured most during our evolution, James once told me, back when we were all still getting acquainted. She tapped her temple. There's a lot of room up here. A modern brain can run dozens of sentient cores without getting too crowded, and parallel multitasking has obvious survival advantages. I nodded. 10 heads are better than 1. Our integration may have actually occurred quite recently. Some experts think we can still revert to multiples under the right circumstances. Well, of course, you're living proof. She shook her head. I'm not talking about physical partitioning. We're state-of-the-art, certainly, but theoretically surgery isn't even necessary. Simple stress could do something like it if it was strong enough, if it happened early in childhood. No kidding. Well, in theory, James admitted and changed into Sasha, who said, Bullshit, in theory, there's documented cases as recently as 50 years ago. Really? I resisted the temptation to look it up on my inlays. The unfocused eyes can be a giveaway. I didn't know. Well, it's not like anyone talks about it now. People were fucking barbarians about multi-cores back then, called it a disorder, treated it like some kind of disease, and their idea of a cure was to keep one of the cores and murder all the others. Not that they called it murder, of course. They called it integration or some shit. That's what people did back then. They created other people to suck up all the abuse and torture, then got rid of them when they weren't needed anymore. It hadn't been the tone most of us were looking for at an ice-breaking party. James had gently eased back into the driver's seat, and the conversation had steered closer to community standards. But I hadn't heard any of the gang use altered to describe each other, then or since. It had seemed innocuous enough when Spindle had said it. I wondered why they'd taken such offense. And now, floating alone in my tent with a few pre-op minutes to kill, there was no one to see my eyes glaze. Alter carried baggage over a century old, consensus told me. Sasha was right. There'd been a time when MCC was MPD, a disorder rather than a complex, and it had never been induced deliberately. According to the experts of that time, multiple personalities arose spontaneously from unimaginable cauldrons of abuse. Fragmentary personae offered up to suffer rapes and beatings while the child behind took to some unknowable sanctuary in the folds of the brain. It was both survival strategy and ritual self-sacrifice, powerless souls hacking themselves to pieces, offering up quivering chunks of self in the desperate hope that the vengeful gods called Mom or Dad might not be insatiable. None of it had been real, as it turned out. Or at least, none of it had been confirmed. The experts of the day had been little more than witch doctors dancing through improvised rituals, meandering free-form interviews full of leading questions and nonverbal cues, scavenger hunts through regurgitated childhoods, sometimes a shot of lithium or haloperidol when the beads and rattles didn't work. The technology to map minds was barely off the ground. The technology to edit them was years away. So the therapists and psychiatrists poked at their victims and invented names for things they didn't understand, and argued over the shrines of Freud and Klein and the old astrologers, doing their very best to sound like practitioners of science. Inevitably, it was science that turned them all into roadkill. MPD was a half-forgotten fad even before the advent of synaptic rewiring. But alter was a word from that time, and its resonance had persisted. Among those who remembered the tale, alter was code speak for betrayal and human sacrifice. Alter meant cannon fodder. Imagining the topology of the gang's coexisting souls, I could see why Sasha embraced the mythology. I could see why Susan led her. After all, there was nothing implausible about the concept. The gang's very existence proved that much. And when you've been peeled off from a pre-existing entity, sculpted from non-existence straight into adulthood, a mere fragment of personhood, without even a full-time body to call your own, you can be forgiven a certain amount of anger. Sure, you're all equal, all in it together. Sure, no persona is better than another. Susan's still the only one with a surname. Better to direct that resentment at old grudges, real or imagined, less problematic, at least, than taking it out on someone who shares the same flesh. I realized something else, too. Surrounded by displays documenting the relentless growth of the Leviathan beneath us, I could not only see why Sasha had objected to the word, I could also see why Isaac Spindle, no doubt unconsciously, had spoken it in the first place. As far as Earth was concerned, everyone on Theseus was an alter.
This ends Disc 4.